It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning to you.
I am in a fine mood this morning, I must say.
And you jumped right in with that, too.
Yeah. As opposed to most Saturday mornings, I'm like, oh, I get out of bed and go down to the radio station, blah, 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 I want to sleep in, blah, 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 blah. But it is actually very fun doing a radio show on Saturday morning, and that is because the Bush administration has raised to a fine art the practice of releasing very bad and damning news late on a Friday afternoon, you know, at the very lowest point of the news week cycle. No newsrooms are staffed on Saturday. The newspapers have already put their Sunday papers to bed, yada, yada. And especially when the D.C. press corps isn't paying attention because the president is somewhere else, like 3,000 miles away in Seattle. So yesterday was a banner news day for bad news being buried by the White House.
Particularly bad environmental news, right?
Yes, and bad environmental news at a time when the president is off doing photo ops on the environment in the Pacific Northwest in front of pretty places. So that was the real significance of Bush's being here yesterday to the rest of the world.
Right. Deliver us in person the bad news.
So we're the backwater that they buried him in while this stuff was coming out in. So I'm doing fine.
All right. Well,
I got to see the limo yesterday.
Do you want to talk about some of that bad environmental news?
Oh, I will.
So yeah, there was a lot of maybe medium-sized protests yesterday all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was out at downtown Bellevue and then Hunts Point, and there were several hundred people at each. I don't know what Victor Steinbrück was like in downtown Seattle, and there was apparently another gathering place in Bellevue, and I'm not sure if those folks wound up over at Hunts Point or not, or if that was separate. I heard a lot of comments in media newsrooms, both at Seattle Weekly, and then I was on Caro Radio last night with Scott Ritter and a guy from Salon, Joe Conacon. I can never quite remember his last name. But that was very good. But you know, everyone was talking about how surprisingly scattered and small the protests seemed to be. And we do have a opportunity to correct that impression today when people have time off work, when it's not the middle of a work day, down at Myrtle Edwards Park at noon. William Rivers Pitt will be the keynote speaker there. I'm also on the bill, as are several other people. And then there'll be a march down to the waterfront. And it's intended to be just the whole polyglot of issues on which the Bush administration has been horrible for the last 2.5 years, consistently horrible. And, sort of a rallying cry of determination that this guy has to be removed in 2004 for the sake of the planet, for the sake of all the nations on the planet, and certainly for the sake of this country and for all of us. So Myrtle Edwards, noon, be there, please, because the impression is out there that, actually the opposition to the president isn't as loud or as determined or as forceful or as important as people thought it might be. Be there.
All right. Anything else on that, or can we jump into some of the fine news that came out yesterday?
I think we should talk about why people ought to be outraged. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, let's start with the EPA.
Yeah, we can. Although, I have to say also, just in general terms, and we talked about Bush's nominee for running the EPA last week, Mike Leavitt, the environmentally destructive governor of Utah, and here's Bush, posing in Oregon in front of forests that are on fire, and then posing for salmon in the Northwest. And I mean, it's like Bush posing for the environment is like, Ted Bundy posing with pretty women. What they don't mention afterwards is he also has a sociopathic urge to murder them. And it's kind of like that with Bush and the environment. You just kind of feel sorry for the salmon at the end of their lives. They go upstream to spawn. They, fight all the fish ladders.
I don't think you were here last week. Were you talking about this on your own?
About Leavitt? The EPA nominee. I thought we had talked about that last week.
No, you weren't here last week.
You weren't here last week, Job. You were out of town camping.
That's right. I wrote about it, but I wasn't here. Anyway, well, well then it's online, and it's
You're in such a good mood.
Yeah, that's true. I wasn't here last week. I was off doing more fun things.
Maria, could you adjust the flow over there?
any event,
I think
that
I turned
is,
it up accidentally.
That is, yeah. What's going through these headphone lines? there is an article in the Weekly this week on how bad Live It is that I wrote too. But there was a damning report yesterday, mm-hmm. And no pun intended, released by the EPA's Inspector General. And we talked about this, and Counterspin talked about this, and many people talked about this at the time after 911 about how toxic the air was with the different materials in the buildings in the World Trade Center when it fell to the airplane attack and mixed with the airliner fuel and all the rest of it after 9/11 and all of the different really, really horrible stew of particulate matter, of heavy metals and all the rest of it that were in the air that New Yorkers were breathing for weeks, and that the APA wouldn't do anything about it. Well, now at the end of the day yesterday comes a report from the EPA's Inspector General that is very nicely laid out with the before and after of the draft of the warnings or reports that were given to the public and people in New York after 9/11, and the final version after it went to the National Security Council and the White House for clearance on the grounds that this was a national security matter. And you can see where all of these different things warning about, you know, people with asthma, the populations at risk, the children, the elderly, and so forth, should be very careful. Those were all taken out completely. All of the things about essentially the public was told that everything is fine, everything is ducky, don't worry, there's nothing wrong here.
So, and they withheld safety information
they
withheld from the U.S. public.
They withheld safety information from the public on very flimsy national security grounds. I mean, what is the national security?
I understand they withheld information like how to go about cleaning some of this dust out of indoor spaces.
One of the things that was changed in there was talking about in the original draft, it was that people who face cleaning jobs in indoor spaces from some of the particulate matter that fell, it's falling like ash for anybody out here who survived Mount St. Helens. It was the same sort of thing in New York, where it's not like snow because it doesn't melt afterwards. You're just stuck with it. You have to clean it up.
You have to find some way to clean it
exactly.
up.
Exactly. And like the Mount St. Helens ash, you know, it's a very fine particulate matter. And just like it gets in car air filters and such, it also gets into your lungs, and it also gets into carpets and, you know, everything else. And with the original EPA draft said that, you know, you need to have experts come in who are trained in particulate, in, you know, hazardous safety material removal, who are trained in this kind of thing, to remove it. And instead, the instruction was, you know, follow the advice of the public officials in New York, who were saying basically, oh, everything's fine. It was, again, a Republican governor, Pataki, who at the time who was sort of complicit in this. But the entire idea that this is something that needs to be taken seriously enough that you need experts to come in and clean it who are trained in this sort of thing, all that was taken out. So it was very, very clearly a case of the White House. This was done at a political level. This was not, you know, the drafts were done by the scientists and the people trained in air quality and safety. The politicians at the top in the National Security Council and the White House used the pretext of national security. And, you know, what are you doing? Telling the terrorists that you know, we use heavy metals and asbestos in building our skyscrapers? I mean, that's not a surprise.
Who doesn't know that?
Yeah, exactly. or you're going to tell the public that you're revealing that the United States has the technology to clean this stuff up. I mean, you know, clearly it was damage control, and it was trying to tell the public that, oh, it's not as bad as it looks like when any moron with an IQ over 30 knows this is bad. This is really bad. So once again, we have, as with the run-up to the war in Iraq and as with environmental policy in general, the White House deciding that if there's news out there, if there are scientific findings out there that don't agree with their worldview or that make them look bad, we can just pretend that it doesn't exist, and the corporate media pretty much obediently follows right along.
So at this point, they should be looking at doing studies and following these people closely.
Well,
for
part of the
healthcare
part of
issues.
The problem with that is that, again, you don't have any baseline to do those studies with, because the White House and the EPA were insisting that nothing was wrong. So you don't have any of those studies that were done in the immediate days after the bombing. So you don't know how bad the exposures were. You had some measurements that were taken in the immediate area of Manhattan, but much of the airflow with that was dumping this stuff over in Brooklyn and to some extent Queens and the East boroughs. And again, the area in which they were doing that kind of containment and those kind of measurements was intentionally minimized by the politicians. So you had only really the Lower East Side and the lower part of Manhattan. Even though, you know, Brooklyn is right across the river from the World Trade Center, and the way the prevailing winds flow. But those measurements weren't taken. So you really have a hard time doing follow-up studies at this point with any kind of precision.
Well, I don't think I'm actually so concerned with the studies, but looking at, you know, bumping up healthcare for all
but
those
again,
people in that area.
Yeah. It's hard to know. I mean, many, many people moved out of the area afterwards. It's hard to know who all was exposed, and it's really hard to go back
afterwards. Yeah, but the people who were
afterwards.
There know if they were exposed. I mean, they know if they were breathing, you know, in the area where the stuff was landing on them. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a no-brainer. They should be able to, you know, go in and request, you know,
well, really, you have to go to Iraq to find any place where the United States is offering free health care. And from what I understand, they're not even doing a very good job there either. Mm.
All right. Well, let's move along. In addition to particulates falling there, I understand everybody's going to be able to get at some of them a little more due to the government backing off on requirements for some of our energy.
The White House, of course, is pretty much in bed with oil and the energy industry, and we found that out once again yesterday, not because the president was standing in front of dams that should be removed, talking about how he loves fish, which apparently he also wants removed, but we also had the leaking, really. It wasn't even an official announcement, but word that came out that the proposed regulations that are going to be coming out probably in the next week or two, and these have been the subject of quite a bit of debate within the EPA, and now that you have Leavitt coming in, the new nominee for the EPA, who hopefully will be challenged by the Democrats in the Senate because his record as a quote-unquote environmentalist in Utah really is very bad. U.S. Magnesium, the worst polluter in the United States for over a decade on the shore of the Great Salt Lake, and leave it, you know, didn't really lift a finger to try and curtail some of their emissions of dioxin and other heavy particulates. And now you've got the EPA saying, well, we're going to promulgate these new regulations that really undermine quite a bit of the Clean Air Act by allowing coal plants that use outmoded technology, some of these older coal plants, particularly in the Midwest and East, that dump huge amounts of particulate matter into the air. I mean, this was the reason you have the term acid rain in the English language, really, that these coal plants are now going to be exempted from much of their cost for any kind of upgrades that they do because they won't have to install pollution control devices. And the idea behind this is that if the pollution control devices are if the upgrades, I'm sorry, are under I think it's $1 billion is the amount that they're going to settle on, that the coal plants will simply be exempt. They won't have to install any of these pollution control devices, whereas now they do, and this actually has improved the air quality in quite a bit of the areas where some of these plants have made the upgrades. But of course, the energy companies don't want to foot the cost for it, just like some of the power companies didn't want to foot the cost for some of the transmission lines, and we got stuck with a blackout as a result a couple weeks ago. We have this whole situation where companies that operate in the public interest under deregulation, under a corporate-friendly administration, are being allowed to skate on some of the essential long-term investment that protects the public in those industries. And again, we're seeing this in the air that we breathe. And you have Salt Lake City, which had clean air 20 years ago, now has tremendously dirty air. Places like Houston, which operate under this yellowish-brown goo that people have to breathe every day, that's President Bush's vision of what every city in this country, including Seattle, our residents are going to breathe, and anybody who's downwind from any of these plants.
So it looks like we're going to be getting cool in more places than our stockings this year.
Yeah, and you know, and also that we're gonna keep having to breathe this stuff until the president stops holding press conferences.
Let's move on. You mentioned the blackouts, the problems that we talked a bit about.
Right,
that
we talked
week.
About that last week, and I made the point that deregulation is really the cause. This week we have a little bit of the details of what actually happened. And it's interesting because it does bear out what I said last week. They've actually tracked it down to two private energy holding companies in the Midwest, First Energy Corp of Akron, Ohio, and American Electric Power of Columbus, Ohio. Now, First Energy is a holding company, an energy holding company that bought up a lot of smaller utility companies in the mid to late 1990s, so it's very heavily in debt.
Very similar to how Enron operated.
Right. And American Electric Power Company of Columbus, Ohio, is a similar energy holding company, and it owned some of the transmission lines. First Energy owned some of the power plants and transmission lines that were involved in Ohio. Now, what happened on August 14th is First Energy's subsidiary in northern Ohio suffered a series of breakdowns on its system. Their coal generation plant, speaking of Midwest coal plants, their coal generation plant shut off. Who knows why? They haven't figured that out yet. And then five transmission lines, some owned by First Energy and some owned by American Electric Power, went down. Now, American Electric Power is known for not taking care of their transmission lines. And in fact, complaints about blackouts with American Electric Power's transmission lines doubled from the year 2001 to 2002. So they've had considerable problems with reliability on their transmission lines. Now, five of the transmission lines owned by these two companies went down. What happened was this created a vacuum. And the way that our system works is when there's a vacuum or there's a blackout, it pulls power from neighboring utilities and neighboring lines to try and fill the vacuum. What this did was it pulled power away from southern Michigan, around the southern Michigan area and the Detroit area, in order to fill the vacuum. This made two Michigan power plants shut down so that they wouldn't overload trying to provide power to the Michigan area as well as to the Ohio area. And this made the vacuum bigger, which drew even more power. Eventually, a dozen power plants shut down in the Michigan area. This created an enormous vacuum on the southern Ontario area, and then it just spread from there into New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Vermont, all over the place.
And this happened in a matter of seconds. This is all computer-generated.
Well, actually, the problem started around 2 p.m. on August 14th, and there was a time window of about an hour and a half where First Energy employees and American Electric Power employees should have gotten on the phone and called Michigan Utilities and said, "We're having trouble. Can you help us out? Can you make sure your power plants don't go offline? We need some of this extra energy." That's the way the system is supposed to work. When you've got problems on your own lines, you're supposed to call your neighbors and let them know so that they can prepare. That didn't happen. So I think there's a question here of, was First Energy understaffed? Were they cutting costs in order to pay down their debt? They didn't make the call. Why didn't they make the call?
Yeah.
That's what really allowed it to spread.
Yeah, well, I was talking about afterwards, once it had spread to Michigan and then to the other states like that.
It shouldn't have spread to Michigan.
No, I understand that.
And when it spread to Michigan, I think there was also a question of why didn't they call Ontario? The people in Ontario didn't hear from the people in Michigan. It just was a total breakdown of communication.
Yeah, I've actually seen some of the things where people in Canada were talking about, well, we should really question whether we want to share energy with the states now, whether we want to have those mutual agreements because of the lack of notification from the United States and the vulnerability they feel because of the lack of investment in infrastructure in the United States, putting southern Ontario, and that's the most populous area of Canada, at risk.
And I think there's also a question of whether they were pushing the envelope on some of these transmission lines in Ohio and Michigan. Now, for safety's sake, in order to prevent blackouts and lines going down, the people who manage these power transmission lines are supposed to keep a little bit of reserve margin on the line. In other words, they're not supposed to run them at capacity 24 hours a day. That reserve margin is supposed to be there in case demand increases on a hot day like it did on August 14th. And it's pretty clear that that wasn't going on. There was no safety margin, and that is probably why that coal-powered plant went down and probably why those transmission lines kicked out. So it was basically greed, mismanagement, and the profit motive, and that's what you get in a deregulated system.
I wouldn't worry. I think we're going to fix all of it pretty soon. Let's move along. Bad situation getting worse in Baghdad this week.
That's right. We had the explosion at the UN compound where so far they found about 23 to 25 dead. They're still digging people out. The bomb was placed directly under the office of the UN envoy to Iraq.
Or next, actually, I think. But yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty much right under his office window. And it came just 2 weeks after the bombing of the Jordanian embassy in Iraq. George Bush, in his speech yesterday, tried to make it sound like it was al-Qaeda terrorists. He was absolutely wrong. He was lying, because it's pretty clear, I don't think anybody disputes this, really, it's very clear that this is part of a series of guerrilla attacks, that the U.S. is the occupying force in Iraq, and this is just one of a whole myriad of tactics that the guerrillas are using to try to drive the U.S. forces out. Now, what interests me about this whole issue is that the U.N. has been playing a key role in Iraq that was hardly mentioned in reports on the bombing and has not been mentioned much in the U.S. press since, is that just 4 days before this bombing, the U.N. Security Council had approved of the new U.S.-appointed governing council in Iraq, and the U.N. had just set up a mission of aid for Iraq in order to, and part of that mission's goal was to help the governing council get started and to do its job. DeMello, the UN envoy to Iraq who was killed in the bombing, he played a very key role in setting up the governing council and getting it started.
Yeah, this clearly, I mean, I actually wrote a column on this Tuesday, literally within hours of the attack, and then I figured there'd be plenty of commentary on this, and almost none of it showed up, at least not in the United States. But this was not a terrorist attack. This was an assassination, and it wasn't just an assassination of DeMello. There were a whole host of high-ranking Western officials that were there. The UN also lost its lead expert on Arab affairs. There were people there from the Food for Oil program. There were at least five employees of the World Bank that were missing after the attack. I mean, there was just this whole list of about a dozen or so fairly high-ranking officials, and you know, the placement of the bomb as close as was possible to DeMello's office, the timing of it, that it happened just as this meeting was taking place, suggests not only that it was an assassination, but that there were people inside the UN compound who had access to that schedule, who knew when those meetings were going to be taking place and who was going to be there at those meetings. It was very carefully planned. It suggests that there is support for the resistance.
The Iraqis that work security for the UN compound.
Many of them are Baathists.
Were former Baathists, and former intelligence people. So I think it's very clear that this was a guerrilla attack, that it had very little or nothing to do with Islamists.
Yeah, when Saddam Hussein was in power, he placed a number of his intelligence people at the UN compound because, of course, that was also the base for the weapons inspectors, mm-hmm. and they wanted that intelligence. And the UN has this whole history of leading the weapons inspection, of enforcing the sanctions, of enforcing the U.S.'s very capricious demands in the management of the Food for Oil program, which Scott Ritter has talked about quite a bit, and Dennis Holliday and some of Hans von Sponeck and many of those folks. All of this is very, very different from the U.N. being portrayed as it was after this attack in the U.S. media as this benign, nonprofit agency that is there only to help the Iraqi people, and that the purpose of this attack was chaos and to discourage aid agencies. It certainly has that effect. It's certainly a different type of tactic, but in the beginning, it was an assassination.
Moving along, Colin Powell also this week goes to the UN looking for
pretty ironic
approval from them, offering nothing in return.
Yeah, it's pretty ironic. The U.S. is now on its knees, begging the UN Security Council nations to send some troops to Iraq to help out. Now, that's a fruitless goal. I mean, because the U.S. has to, in order to get France, Germany, Russia, some of these other nations to give up a sizable force, which it's not clear they even have available, since a lot of French and German troops are tied up elsewhere around the world doing other sorts of NATO and UN assignments. The U.S. has to give up a little bit of control in Iraq, and that's not going to happen because, as we now know, Donald Rumsfeld is in charge of the U.S. foreign policy and the U.S. government, and what he says goes, and what he has been saying this week is we don't need more troops there, and it's Colin Powell who's trying to negotiate the new troops coming in, and nobody is taking Colin Powell seriously anymore because they understand that he is routinely being undercut by the Bush administration.
And the idea of Donald Rumsfeld running U.S. foreign policy should strike terror into every person in the country and the world.
Yeah. The point that I want to make is that some of the countries that already have troops in Iraq are starting to pull back their troops. Poland withdrew its troops from a 1,000 square kilometer region just south of Baghdad because of the UN bombing and the security situation. Japan has now postponed deployment of 1,000 troops because of the UN bombing. Thailand is reviewing its decision to send 400 troops. And now Turkey is engaging in this massive fight in the Turkish parliament over whether or not they really do want to send those 10,000 troops that their president promised. So not only are we not getting more troops from the UN, we're maybe starting to lose the foreign troops that are there in the country right now.
And it's looking like our partners in their countries are starting to question quite heavily what the heck they're doing there.
That's right.
And you have these questioning in places like Australia and really in Britain, the commissions about the lying of the governments and how they got there in the first place.
Yeah, this week that was the last thing I want to talk about in Iraq is that this week all heck's breaking loose in Britain and Australia with these reports coming out in front of the British Parliament and coming out in the Australian Parliament in these ongoing investigations of whether their governments lied about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction capability. And in Britain, we had Tony Blair's chief of staff, Jonathan Powell, surrendered an email that said it would be wrong to claim in the British government dossier that Iraq posed an imminent threat to the world. Now, that goes right to the heart of Tony Blair's inner circle, people in his inner circle saying that Iraq is no threat to the world. That's pretty amazing, and that is what's coming out.
And then the Blair government turned around and said that it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then in Australia, you had a former government intelligence analyst, Andrew Wilkie, who worked directly on Iraq intelligence, and he had resigned when the Australian government altered data, in his opinion. Here's a quote. He said, "Sometimes the exaggeration was so great, it was clear dishonesty." Now, he told this to the Australian Parliament, and after he testified, they had Richard Butler testify. People will remember that when Scott Ritter quit as the head of the UN weapons inspectors, that Richard Butler took over. He's a hardline, true believer kind of guy. He really believed right up until just a few weeks ago that there were a lot of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He told this Australian Parliament that he was deeply shaken when there were no weapons of mass destruction found, and he believes that the Bush administration should release at least the interviews that have been done with captured Iraqi government officials and scientists in order to clear up the reasons why no weapons of mass destruction have been found. This is an amazing thing. This man is not being interviewed, and it's because his true believer faith in the weapons of mass destruction has been so deeply shaken.
It's a 180-degree turnaround.
It's a complete turnaround for him.
This was the guy they brought out early on to contradict everything Ritter was saying.
Yeah, so this is pretty amazing.
Turn of events. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Mm-hmm. And one of you, tell us, where can we find Eat the State?
Well, first of all, you can find it at Myrtle Edwards Park today at noon with the anti-Bush rally. I'm sure we'll have some copies floating around. And then we will have a new issue coming out this coming week that will have our election picks and endorsements and many other good things on some of the issues you hear on this program. It comes out every other week, free paper that it. You can get it places where you find bookstores and cafes and free papers of all sorts. You can also find it on the web at www.eatthestate.org. If you have tips, comments, feedback, if you can't find it in your neighborhood and want to find out where the heck it is, our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.
Very good.
I didn't forget that even when I was in the woods.
I'm sure it came in handy. All right.